NPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Fundamental debates over what the state government's priorities should be and how to fund those priorities continue this week in the legislature. The Republican-led Senate began in earnest its work on the budget, with senators making it clear their vision will be very different from that of the Democratic House. But as that ongoing story moved into its next phase, Granite State headlines were grabbed by two other developments this week, both regarding our environment. First, state forestry officials announced an unwelcome traveler from the Midwest had arrived in New Hampshire, the emerald ash borer. It's unclear how this invasive beetle made it here, but its presence could be devastating for our ash trees. Meanwhile, another environmental issue, this one concerning water quality, hit a milestone this week. A jury reached a verdict on Tuesday in a court case over ExxonMobil's use of the gasoline additive MTBE, which was found to contaminate drinking water. Jurors decided on a record award amount of more than $200 million in damages to the state. ExxonMobil says it will appeal and that New Hampshire is just looking for a scapegoat. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'll catch up on the top stories of the week. Let's hear from you, too. What are some of the topics that have been front and center in your mind this week? What do you want to know more about, whether it's these environmental stories or the coming debate over the budget and gambling in the House and Senate? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We're going to begin the hour with NHPR environment reporter Sam Evans-Brown for more on the ash borer and the MTBE story. And Sam, thanks a lot for your time.
Happy to be here, Laura.
Well, let's start with the ash borer. That really seemed to have people upset. How come?
Well, it's killed millions and millions of trees in Michigan, where it was first found, and of course spreading across the Midwest toward New Hampshire. And there's 25 million trees in ash trees in New Hampshire. It's 6% of our forest. It's a great lumber tree. Folks who are in that industry, of course, are happy to have those trees around. So it's a sad thing to get this type of news that something that has proved absolutely unstoppable in the Midwest has been found here in Concord.
Wow. And did they find evidence of the ash borer, Sam, or did they find the actual beetle itself?
Now, I believe that what they have said is that they found insect material in the tree. I believe probably what that means is they found larvae or egg cells. I know that they found galleries, which are the spaces in which the beetles are actually burrowing underneath the bark. I saw some of those myself. But it is 100%, you know, sure thing that it is the ash borer. They found insect material.
What struck me about your story, Sam, a couple things. One was, you found this not in some, you know, lovely remote forest in the Lakes region of the North Country, but kind of in a crummy section of town right here in Concord.
Well, I'm sure the people who live and work there probably don't consider it crummy, but
it's right off the highway.
Right, yeah. It's an industrial park. And it did sort of sneak past our defenses. There were all sorts of these traps that they had set up down south in the Keene area along the border because they were expecting it to come north. That it would have to pass through those defenses. They also had these wasp traps that are actually kind of a fascinating thing. They set up, there's a wasp that predates these beetles, and they just have a nest, and the wasp will go out and catch them, and they can just catch the wasp in a net, and if it's got an ash borer, then you've detected it in a mile radius. And all of that was to the south, and it really just, it snuck right by all those defenses.
Wow, so people weren't expecting it right off I-93 in Concord.
No, and it was probably came off some nursery stock or off somebody's firewood that was just going by on the highway is one possibility, or it's also very possible that this is not the first tree, but there's some other tree somewhere else, maybe near a campsite that somebody brought it up in firewood that just did not obey the quarantine.
So how fast can these beetles spread their devastation once they establish themselves, Sam?
Right. So they move at about a rate of about a half mile a year if left to their own devices. However, what we've seen in the past is that they move in great leaps because, like I was saying, they move in firewood. But when we talk about percentage of trees in an area, it really takes, once you detect the population, that's a good indication that the infestation has already spread pretty far within the individual trees. So it's probably been there for a few years already. So once you've detected that population, it can take as few as 8 years to have 100% of the trees in an area infested. And once they're infested, they're toast.
Well, so how has the Midwest dealt with this?
Well, there have been, you know, I talked to a couple folks out there for my story, and they're, for a while, they seemed so unstoppable that communities would find that they're infested, and they would just give up. They would cut down trees. But since then, they've discovered there are some pesticide treatments that can save individual, quote, high-value trees. So we're talking about trees in city areas that have been planted. Now, a lot of ash trees were planted in cities after Dutch elm disease swept through and took out all the elms. So, you know, they're a very ornamental tree that have been put in place in a lot of cities. And so if you want to save those trees, you can save them with pesticides. You have to treat them for about 10 years waiting for this tidal.
A long time.
Well, you have to wait for this sort of tidal wave of beetles to pass through, and then once the population declines, you can sort of ease back off the pesticides, is the theory anyway. This is still all untested.
So what do state forestry officials do next with this?
Well, first they have to determine the scope of the infestation. So they're, you know, in the next couple weeks, next month or so, they're going to be taking cuttings from trees all through Concord, and they're going to try to find the boundaries of where the beetles are already, and then you know they will take action by cutting down some trees that are too far gone. They can treat with pesticides others that can be saved. And, you know, the end game here is counting on the populations of these wasps that do eat the beetles to come up and hope that they will start to keep that population in check. You can also introduce some Asian wasps that regulators say that it's safe enough to bring them in, that they only eat the beetle, you can bring them in, and they will hopefully, after decades, and we're talking really, this is a long-term solution, can their population can start to keep the beetles in check.
So if you see a wasp buzzing around you this summer, don't slap it.
And
the state
a
favor.
They are non-stinging wasps, so don't worry about them.
Well, a busy week for you, Sam Evans-Brown. There was another huge environmental story this week. The MTBE case, said to be the longest lawsuit in New Hampshire history, the most expensive award ever. Let's just untangle that for a couple minutes, if we could, please. First, the longest in state history. How far back does this suit go?
So this started under Governor Craig Benson and his Attorney General Peter Heed in 2003. It's actually kind of a fascinating thing to listen back and hear a Republican governor talking about taking the big oil companies to task. But that was when that started. And, you know, it's been going on ever since. They've, you know, talked about 8 million documents in evidence, 3 months of evidentiary hearings. It really was quite a thing to undergo.
Well, MTBE was first praised as a gasoline additive because it helped reduce smog. So who told the oil companies or encouraged them to start using this?
Right. So the Clean Air Act. So it was Congress, through the Clean Air Act, that then rules were written by the EPA saying we had to reduce smog. However, they left it open as to how you reduce that smog. And there are a number of gasoline additives that can do that. Currently, what's in our gas is ethanol, which I'm sure everyone will see. You go to the pump, there's a little sticker there, 10% ethanol. However, at the time, companies didn't want to use that because automakers weren't sure that it was going to be safe to put it in cars. They thought it would damage cars' engines. It wasn't clear that it was going to be widely enough available. So MTBE was really seen as this sort of miracle additive. It did everything that they were hoping it would do, and it was cheap and it was available. However, there were concerns from the beginning. The state's lawyers like to point out that the ExxonMobil scientists already knew that there was a possibility that this could get into groundwater. It was at the time was called the Houdini of contaminants. It gets out and it's hard to keep from seeping into groundwater. So folks knew that this was going to be a tricky one to contain from the beginning. But it was really just an economic decision.
So pretty soon therein, are you saying, Sam, folks started becoming aware that MTBE was contaminated drinking water. A couple years into this experiment, this smog-reducing experiment, they said, ooh, this stuff is starting to show up in my well.
Right. So mid to late 90s is when they started to ramp up the use of MTBE in gasoline. And then in the early 2000s was when, you know, New Hampshire was the first state to bring a lawsuit. And that lawsuit happened in 2003. So, you know, less than a decade was this sort of boom time for MTBE.
So from what I understand, Sam, all the other oil companies have already settled with the states on this. Why is Exxon holding out?
So they just think they have a good case. I mean, the other companies were obviously just making an economic calculus, thinking how likely are we to win this trial and how much is going to cost us in lawyer fees. And so
is it worth it?
Right, exactly. And ExxonMobil really just felt that, you know, the EPA signed off on us using this chemical. It was the only one that we could have used. It's not fair for. And also, they say, what's the damage? We talk about the contamination to thousands of wells. Well, show me evidence that it has actually hurt people and that, you know, people have been slow to produce that. Of course, it hasn't been widely studied yet, so it's hard to say exactly what the damage is. And that was their argument, and they feel that it's a good one. In Maryland, the state's highest court there turned over rulings that would have awarded $1.6 billion.
Wow.
Yeah, so even larger rulings there were overturned by the Maryland court, but in New York, a district federal court, a federal district court, upheld a similar hearing or similar ruling for about $100 million. So, you know, it's unclear exactly how strong these arguments are, and we'll find out going forward.
$100 million. So last question for you, Sam. New Hampshire, the jury in New Hampshire awarded more than $230 million, and ExxonMobil kind of said, whoa, wait a minute. That's way too much. You're just looking for some cash here, folks.
Well, you know, certainly at the hearing where the attorney general was announcing this award, you could tell all the reporters knew that that there will be politics involved in this, and if that money comes in, it's going to go into the state budget somehow. You know, some of it's going to go towards cleaning up groundwater, but you never know with these rulings. The legislature budget writers do tend to like these kinds of one-time infusions of cash. However, it's years out if we're going to see any of this money, because it's going to go through lots and lots of appeals, and who knows how far that will go.
Nobody's expecting to see any money right away to fill this year's budget hole.
Certainly not.
For example.
Yeah. However, there are the other oil companies who had settled that have brought $136 million into the state. Some of that's trickling in now. Other amounts will take a little longer. About $96 million, I think, is the number of how much the state will actually see after court fees and such have been taken out.
Yeah, and I think someone from the Attorney General's office said, correct me if I'm wrong, Sam, said, well, in terms of what we do with the award money, you know, we've already spent money on our end taking care of this years back, so we can kind of do what we want with this.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think that there was a lot of talk of let's use this to improve groundwater quality in New Hampshire, but we'll see. I mean, these money gets political, so we'll see what happens.
All right, Sam, thanks a lot for coming in. We really appreciate you filling us in on these stories.
Anytime, Laura.
That's NHPR's environment reporter, Sam Evans-Brown, helping us out with a couple environmental stories that broke this week. It is our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'll be talking about the latest goings-on in our state. We want to hear from you. The number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Some scattered showers for today, mixing with some sleet across southern New Hampshire. Central and northern New Hampshire will see a mix of rain, sleet, or snow, mostly in higher elevations. Much of the state is under a winter weather advisory today. Highs 33 to 38 degrees. More of our Friday news roundup on The Exchange and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the domestic hour of the Friday news roundup. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Liberty Utilities, sponsors of 10 button-up New Hampshire home weatherization workshops, including April 15th at the Bedford Public Library. For details, email nhsaves@libertyutilities.com. From Crisis Center of Central New Hampshire, supporting domestic and sexual violence survivors, marks its 35th anniversary at Red River Theater April 17th. Details at Crisis Center of New Hampshire Facebook page. And from Antioch University, New England and Keene, offering 7 different master's and doctoral programs in environmental studies, antiochne.edu. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're looking at some of the top stories of the week in the Granite State. Among them, the Senate's tackling of the state budget and the many groups gearing up for the House's vote on gambling next week. Let's get your thoughts on that. Also, there was a hearing on medical marijuana this week in the Senate. We'll look at that and the nomination hearings for Joe Foster as the new state attorney general. We want your thoughts, questions, and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. With me in studio, Dan Toohey, Assistant Regional Editor for Patch.com in New Hampshire. Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Also with us, Norma Love, Statehouse Reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, thanks for taking the time.
Good morning.
And also with us, Kevin Landrigan, Statehouse and Political Reporter for the Nashua Telegraph and lead writer for the Lobby NH.com. And Kevin, thank you very much for being
here.
Sure,
great to be here.
Well, and all of you, as we've discussed many times before, for on this program. Governor Hassan wants to pay for her priorities with $80 million in license fees she predicts that a new casino would bring in. Senate's on board with this. The House has voted against other gambling proposals, but hasn't Norma Love voted on this one yet? So give us an update there.
Well, this coming Tuesday, the House will hold a hearing, and they've created a super committee of the House Finance and House Ways and Means committees to do it as a joint so they don't have one do it and then refer the bill to another. So there'll be one vote on this bill. They're also going to have subcommittees to look at revenue, to look at regulation, some issues that will completely take this bill apart, look at it from all angles, and then they'll come back with a recommendation to the House. The House has never approved casino gambling. There's a lot of pressure from Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan on the House, which is controlled by Democrats, but not by a huge, huge majority. And Speaker Norelli has said that this is going to be a vote of conscience. I think she wants this to be a transparent process. I think probably, if I had to guess, they'll bring the bill to a vote somewhere in the middle to the latter third week of May. There is a lot of speculation about whether this bill, if it goes down in the House, would pop up again during the budget debate.
As part of budget negotiations
correct.
In June, yeah.
And I used to think that was true. I think it's less likely now. I think if it's a close vote in May, maybe. If it goes down resoundingly, it probably won't be back.
Wow. Well, and I just want to let everybody know that Governor Hassan is coming on our show on Monday on The Exchange. So we'll for sure be talking more about this vote in the House. Dan Tuohy, just remind us, you know, again, the House has voted on other gambling bills before, but this is kind of the big kahuna, isn't it?
It is. This is the bill that has many sponsors, but the prime sponsors here are Lou D'Alessandro, the Democratic senator from Manchester, longtime advocate for expanded gambling, and Chuck Morse, a Republican from Salem. He's also supported expanded gambling for Rockingham Park as well. This bill passed the Senate by 16-8 vote.
Wow.
And if this is the bill that calls for one high-end casino location in southern New Hampshire. It would be up to, I believe, 150 table games and up to 5,000 machines. So there's many questions that will be ferreting out here in the House review of this bill, but I know what some people in the House have also said, please define a high-end casino. What does it mean? There's some other businesses such as the Verizon Center and some reps in Manchester. They don't want competition for the Verizon Wireless Arena. So we'll begin to see a little more, especially from critics and advocates alike, what they want or don't want in this legislation.
And this is really the bill that Governor Hassan wants, Dan.
Yes.
She
has supported this bill.
In.
Obviously, she wants to see what how this bill is modified and amended, if it is.
Yeah, and one more thing that you mentioned that's interesting, and you're right, it just came out, Dan. You mentioned concerns by the Verizon Center and other entertainment venues, the Palace Theater, the ballroom in Hampton Beach. Cannibalization, that's where people are worried that if a casino comes in, it sucks up revenue that used to go to other restaurants and entertainment venues and bars and so forth. Casino supporters have said in the past, no, this won't happen. Now, though, just recently, there has been some very publicly expressed concern that, you know, people might go to the casino and not go to the Verizon Center anymore.
Well, that's the concern that was expressed by the Manchester rep, Pat Patrick Long. This has been from Governor Hassan's budget delivery back in February is, look, gambling's already here. It's already here. And in the House discussion of some gambling, a different gambling bill last month, there was Ken Wyler, a Republican from Kingston, essentially offering the same argument that gambling's already here. Let's not fool anyone.
All right. Let me give out the phone number, and then I have a couple questions more on this. The number for you to join our conversation today on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us as we talk about the latest concerning the Senate's take on the budget, gambling coming to the House. Later on, we'll talk about the nomination of Joe Foster as Attorney General, and we'll look at some political news here in the state. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Kevin Landrigan, yet another development on this casino front. Seems like every couple of days, another group comes out in favor or against this casino idea. A new group came out this week, Kevin, called Casino Free New Hampshire. Who are they? What do they add to this discussion?
Yeah, the folks who formed Casino Free New Hampshire, many of them have been opponents of expanded gambling before. former House Finance Chairman Marjorie Smith, former Attorney General Phil McLaughlin, Lou Feldstein, who's the retired president of New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, making many of the same arguments that have been made before. The kind of umbrella group against expanded gambling, the Grand Estate Coalition against expanded gambling, has been kind of a pretty much of a bipartisan group. Its membership has a number of prominent Republicans in it. Jim Rubens, who's the chairman, is a former Republican state senator. This casino-free New Hampshire sort of is coming at it, I think, more from the progressive perspective, and I think their argument essentially is that this revenue is not only unreliable, as we've just seen in the discussion we're having about the state budget. The House of Representatives was able to put together a budget without this casino license fee money. It can be done. We don't need the social costs that would come from a casino.
Norma.
Well, I think exactly what Kevin said is coming from a more progressive group, and they were quizzed at their news conference repeatedly, well, this or an income tax, and they deferred. They said, well, that's not on the table to discuss. But it put them in probably a little bit of an uncomfortable position because many of the members in this group have lobbied in the past for more spending for things that Democrats traditionally support. So you have Jim Rubens and the Republicans are coming at it from one group, one angle, and then you have the this more liberal progressive group coming at it, and they're saying to the I think they're going to reach out to the House members that they think are wavering, saying, we don't need this. We really don't need this, and it's really not a choice between gambling or nothing. We want to have a discussion about an income tax or a sales tax or anything else. That's for another day.
All right, here's an email to that effect. This is from Christopher in Manchester. He says, there seems to be growing organized opposition to gambling. Please comment on the potential effects of the new group, mostly liberal Democrats, which surfaced this week. And Christopher, thanks for the email. So the effects, Kevin Landrigan. Okay, now we have two groups working at this from slightly different political angles. So what's the impact?
Well, what's interesting about this debate, I think, is at the end of the day, I think the House Democratic Caucus is going to determine whether casino gambling goes through. I think the problem that supporters of a casino have with the Republican Party are the two segments of the GOP that have problems with this bill. The first group are primarily libertarian-minded Republicans who are opposed to a monopoly, who don't like the idea of having only one private company control this business. And the other segment of the Republican Party that's against this are law enforcement Republicans who are listening to their local police chiefs who are essentially saying a casino is going to mean more crime, more welfare, more problems on the street. So I think the Democrats are really going to determine this debate. That's one of the reasons why I think the Speaker decided to create this super committee, as Norma referred to it. I think she's trying to essentially give Governor Hassan a decent shot at getting a decent vote.
Even though Speaker Norelli herself has not been thrilled with gambling.
Right. In the past, has voted against gambling. But clearly, if this bill had gone to the first committee, the House Ways and Means Committee that generally deals with gambling bills, it would come out with a negative recommendation of at least 2-1. There are a number of Democrats on the Finance Committee who don't have a philosophical problem with gambling. So there's a belief that even if it's a negative recommendation from this super committee, it's not going to be so lopsided that it really colors the debate and makes it almost impossible to try and pass it.
Wow, that's interesting. So on the surface of it, you know, this committee or that committee, to the uninitiated, Kevin, it doesn't seem like a big deal. Who cares? But you're saying this is a very calculated decision by Speaker Norelli to not give Governor Hassan's proposal such a down vote, so to speak, not to make it seem like it's going down to smashing defeat.
Yeah, and both sides obviously are watching this issue very closely. So, for example, when they announced these subcommittees, these working groups that Norma referred to that are going to kind of pick this bill apart, everybody's looking at who's running these subcommittees. Are they pro-gambling? Are they anti-gambling? Because every decision that's made at this stage can really color how this bill gets shaped in this committee.
Dan Toohey, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, one of the subcommittees we're talking about here is community impact That's an interesting name for a subcommittee, of course. But that's the concern that critics have had all along, is that this is going to ruin New Hampshire, that it's going to – these social ills of gambling, whether it's problem gambling or type of that proliferation, whether they're real or perceived, that subcommittee is going to be really fascinating to watch what they hear and what they come to a conclusion.
I think that it really comes down to brand, as we and the casino supporters say. It's not, you know, Massachusetts is going to do this. We already have the ills. Hey, we aren't branding New Hampshire in a negative way. We're giving them a positive brand. The other side is saying New Hampshire's always had this family-friendly brand, tourist brand, place to come, go boating, go hiking, whatever. This is going to be a negative brand. So which side do you think the brand is on?
All right. Well, let me also invite you to join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. It's our New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. What are some of the topics that have been front and center in your mind this week? What do you want to know more about? Whether it's this continued debate over gambling, which, as we're hearing, is coming to the House next week. It's a big deal with this super committee looking at this issue. Also, the Senate has started looking at the budget in its own way. If you have questions or comments about that, we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And other legislative news, folks. Norma, let's talk about medical marijuana. It passed overwhelmingly in the House. It's now before the state Senate. Just remind us what this bill looks like, what's being debated here.
Well, it comes down to whether you want to have a combination bill. In the past, we've fought over whether we would have a pharmacy model, which means that people would go to what they call either a compassion center, whatever you want to label it, sort of like a pharmacy, and you would have you or your caretaker would be approved to go and get a certain amount of marijuana, or would you be allowed to grow it at home? And I was looking at this yesterday, and the governor has supported both. But right now, they're being very cautious about what they will say on whether they would support this bill because it has both in it.
A little grow at home, and also you have to go to a particular center.
And the amount that you could have has changed. I think it was 6 plants and now it's 3. So amount of a marijuana that you could have keeps shifting. But the basic premise is that you would either be able to go someplace and buy it or you'd be able to grow it at home. And some people are saying they can't really afford to go to a pharmacy model and pay, you know, a couple hundred dollars for an ounce of marijuana, whatever it would cost. But if they could grow it at home and have a little bit, not only that, it would be more convenient. It would be difficult to get to a pharmacy or a caretaker to get to a pharmacy model type shop. So that's really the debate. And yesterday we tried to put the question to the governor, and she kind of deferred as to she still wants to talk to stakeholders. So it's hard to know. But in 2009, bill came over from the House that was crafted from a Democratic Senate with Hassan as in the Senate at that time, that was home grow, and she voted for that. Went back, and the House said, we don't like it, and it went to conference and came out pharmacy model. She voted for that.
So we're not really sure where she stands on
this.
No,
and Lynch vetoed it, and she voted to override, but it failed. So now we're back last year. Hassan wasn't in the Senate, and we had a home grow. And ironically, some of the people who voted on one side or the other in 2009, like Senate President Peter Bragdon, have switched. So it's hard to know where anybody is and what whether they've evolved. I think some have. I think Jeb Bradley, for example, the Republican majority leader, has evolved. But where everybody's going to come down on this, I don't think it's settled yet.
Wow. Really interesting, because, again, it passed overwhelmingly in the House. What do you think, Dan?
Well, as I understand it, the governor met with a few of the stakeholders yesterday, a handful of people who would benefit from this bill, people that are afflicted with terminal issues that would have some sort of respite from the bill. You know, this has really evolved. It's really fascinating to watch. 14 states now have some sort of a home grow provision in their laws, including, of course, Vermont. They've had there since 2004, I believe. And, you know, advocates for this bill say, look, Vermont it's an existing law that's proven successful. And the other number that I keep coming back to is the estimate of the number of people here in New Hampshire that would be able to make use of this law if it becomes law. is approximately 600 to 800 people.
Because they've got a pretty tight list, Dan, as I understand, of
yes.
conditions under which you would be able to access medical marijuana.
Exactly, Laura.
So not that many people. Pretty strict system. Kevin,
yeah,
did you want to jump
in? One of the ways this bill has been crafted that's different in the past, it essentially says that you both have to have this debilitating condition, be it cancer or a terminal illness, as Dan referred to. And you also, at the time you're trying to obtain the marijuana, you have to have these symptoms that so if you, for example, have cancer but the cancer's in remission, you can't get the marijuana. And that's one way in which they've tried to tighten up this bill. And what was interesting about the hearing yesterday is the debate at the hearing really wasn't about, is this a good idea or is this a bad idea? I think the supporters understand that at the end of the day, they're really talking to Governor Hassan, and they're really trying to convince her that this grow-your-own model has to be part of the picture for a couple of reasons. One, in most states that have adopted these dispensaries, it's taken years for them to be up and running, and many of these folks say, we don't have that time. The other issue about a dispensary is cost, that obtaining the marijuana at a dispensary would be much more expensive for patients than if they were able to grow their own.
So there's been this shift, it seems like, Norma, from, you know, pro-con, yes, we should, no, we shouldn't, almost more to, judging from what Kevin said and from what I've heard, it's now, what do we want this to look like?
I think what it's going to come down to is politics. I don't think, you hear the debate, I don't think anyone is denying that there's support or that the governor has supported it in the past or continues to support it. I think it's going to come down to the politics of what will work politically. Where will I get stung the least? If we go forward with a home grow, and I mean, I think the Police Chiefs Association would like everyone to have a criminal background check. What if you have these massive, I don't think it's happened, but that's the fear. And you don't want to get stung with that. Politically, you know, 2 years from now or whenever. So I think it's a matter of how are we going to regulate it, how are we going to control it, and politically what is going to work, whether it's both or one.
All right. Well, after a short break, we'll take your questions and comments about some of these news stories that we're covering this week. Again, we're looking at the evolution of the gambling debate. You can chime in on that. Also, the vote last week on medical marijuana. Coming up, a couple political stories, too, that we'll cover, including the North Country Republican Committee holding a vote of no confidence in the new party chair, Jennifer Horn. We'll talk about that after a short break and take your calls and emails, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members in Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 49 restaurants now to the 13th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. From LaValle and Middleton Building Supply, offering exterior portfolio siding to rejuvenate your home's exterior with installation available. Information at lavalleys.com. And Elliott Orthopedic Surgical Specialist at Elliott at River's Edge in downtown Manchester, providing replacement, repair, reconstruction of the hand, hip, shoulder, and knee. This is NHPR.
You may not be able to tell by the weather, but it is spring, a time when we all start clearing out the clutter we've accumulated over the cold months. If you have an old car that you'd like to clear out but don't know what to do with, donate it to NHPR. We take care of everything, the paperwork, the pickup. All you have to do is sign the dotted line and accept your charitable gift receipt. Put a spring in your step with a gift to your favorite public radio station. Call 1-877-393-NHPR or visit nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan joins us for a look back at her first 100 days in office. Now, you can email us your questions for the governor in advance, if you'd like, before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And then be sure to join us Monday morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're talking about some of the top stories that Granite Staters were talking about this week. We'd want to hear what's on your mind from the news you heard this week. How are you feeling about some of these issues, such as the ongoing debate over casino gambling, the vote or the hearing this week on medical marijuana? Also, in a minute, we'll talk about the nomination hearing for Joe Foster as New Hampshire's new Attorney General. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Kevin Landrigan, Norma Love, Dan Tuohy, let's go right to our listeners now. And Justin's waiting in Keene. Hi, Justin, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd just like to applaud the efforts being made by the Senate and the House to pass a medical marijuana bill. But I'd like to see it go even a step further and push towards the outright legalization and decriminalization of marijuana in the state. And I think it could be a real benefit to our local economies, and I think it would be better spent than debating a gambling bill.
Thanks for the call, Justin. I'm glad he jumped in, Kevin, because there was a discussion this week in the legislature about decriminalization, not medical marijuana, but decriminalizing possession of marijuana.
Yeah, the House has passed a bill which essentially would change possession of a quarter ounce of marijuana or less to a violation rather than a crime, would carry a $200 fine. The bill's got real problems in the state Senate. Historically, the Senate's rejected this idea. The House has passed it several times before. There were the biggest problem it really had at the hearing this week was essentially one of its biggest philosophical supporters, Matt Simon with the Marijuana Policy Project, essentially said this bill has flaws. It needs work. We'd prefer you to study it for another year. And his emphasis is really on the medical marijuana bill and understands that any legislature only has a certain amount of appetite for one issue. And to try and adopt multiple marijuana bills is not going to happen this year. We also have Governor Hassan, who's essentially said, I'm against any decriminalization measures.
Yeah, so pretty savvy political move on Matt Simon's part, right, saying, look, there's only so much we can do in 1 year. Thanks for that call, Justin. Our number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's a Facebook comment from Ryan, who asks, how will the revenue generated by a casino be used to benefit New Hampshire if the bill is passed? Norma, what do you think?
Well, there's the lion's share of it would go to the state, but a little piece of it would go to the community that is the host community and some to surrounding communities, and a little bit would go to help treat a problem gambling addiction.
But this is the conundrum for Democrats, right? I mean, they would like to have this money to spend on universities and mental health and education and so forth.
Well, the Senate bill proposes to earmark at least the license. Some of the revenue, not the licensing fee, I'm sorry, to improve highways. For example, the top choice would be to finish I-93, the expansion. They haven't got enough money to finish or get to bond the $250 million they need to go all the way up to Manchester. And it's no surprise that some of the prime supporters of the gambling bill are from that area. Another piece would be for higher education, and some would go to developing the North Country. That's all well and good, but I think the Democrats who've been around a long time also know that money is fungible. It comes into the budget, and anytime you earmark things, it tends to get unearmarked rather rapidly.
we have seen that with other programs.
A good example would be Ned Gordon, who's a circuit court judge now. When he was in the Senate a number of years ago, helped push through a bill to put a certain percentage of liquor revenues towards treatment programs, which has never happened. As soon as he left the Senate, whatever money was going, it was capped, and the rest of it is perennially gone into the budget. So I think Democrats who've been around a long time are suspicious.
All right. Well, Ryan, thanks for the question. Again, you can post a comment on our Facebook page or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And folks, you know, as we've been talking about casino gambling, it keeps coming up everywhere we look. Kevin Landrigan, it came up this week in the nomination hearings for Joe Foster to become the new Attorney General for New Hampshire. Now, what's the gambling connection there?
Well, he was the vice chairman of a commission that former Governor John Lynch had named to look at the gambling issue. When Governor Lynch agreed to this commission, essentially as an olive branch, if you will, to the Senate that really wanted expanded gambling at the time. His record in the state Senate, Joe Foster was former Senate Majority Leader, served for 6 years there. He really only voted on one piece of legislation in the Senate against expanded gambling, essentially a bill for multiple casinos. At the hearing before the executive council this week, Joe Foster emphasized that as Attorney General, he would carry out what was the one recommendation of this diverse commission that all members agreed very strongly about, which was there needs to be a strong regulatory regime in place before you have a casino operating there. And right now, there really isn't.
Yeah, so that came up during his hearing. But otherwise, you tweeted, Kevin, New Hampshire Attorney General nominee Joe Foster faces public hearing, love fest likely.
Yeah, well, Joe Foster was a very popular legislator. As I said, he was the Senate Majority Leader before Maggie Hassan, the governor, was Senate Majority Leader. That's the relationship they certainly have. And probably his most important attribute, frankly, is that he's a moderate Democrat. He's a centrist Democrat. The activists in the Democratic Party are very happy to see Maggie Hassan name one of their own as an attorney general, and that's helped him a great deal. He's also someone who worked very well with Republicans when he was a legislator for 10 years. He was in the House for 4 years. And so you had a number of Republican legislators, businessmen, lawyers, all come to the hearing and say, this is a very fair, thoughtful guy. We can work with him, and we'd like you to support him.
Yeah, you had people on both sides. Bob Clegg, right, for example, he's certainly no liberal. He's a conservative Republican, and he came out in support of Joe Foster. Again, our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Give us your thoughts, questions or comments on some of the news items that we're talking about this week, whether it's the ongoing debate over casino gambling, the hearing this week on medical marijuana, and some of the political stories. Joe Foster trying to become attorney general. I've got another political story I'd like to ask you all about, and Dan Tuohy, I'll turn to you first. The Coos County Republican Committee this week approved a no-confidence resolution in Jennifer Horn, the relatively new New Hampshire Republican chairwoman. They said that they were doing this for two reasons, and I'm reading from their release here. Whereas the recent attack on longtime New Hampshire Republican State Committee Treasurer Robert Scott by Chairman Horn has distracted the party from its objectives, and whereas Chairman Horn's personal financial troubles have become a liability to the party. Were you surprised by this when this came across your desk?
Yeah, I think so, Laura. I mean, I think it was such an interesting email. I think most of the press in New Hampshire got that, one of the emails, and it was late at night, and it was like, all right, what's going on here? It was a teleconference call. You had the vice chairman as well coming out saying, well, it wasn't the full committee up in Coos County. But still, it's the issue that's sticking out there. You read it on Granite Grok, the conservative blog. The union leader's written about it as well. And it's like, what does Jennifer Horn have to do to appease every Republican in the state? Well, there's nothing she can do to appease every Republican in the state. It's a very difficult job. But as you know, people have pointed out time and again, like, well, the Democrats have Ray Buckley over there, consistent. But, you know, the Republicans have a tougher road to hoe, so to speak. They're coming off a tough election cycle. They're looking to make this midterm election win for them. So they got to shake it up. And Jennifer Horn's trying to do that.
Yeah, well, and picking up on what he said, Norma, I mean, he's right. Ray Buckley's been there heading the Democratic Party for about a decade. You know, I'm not sure of the exact dates. And the Republicans keep switching their chairs. It's kind of musical chairs over there. They've had at least four or five people over the past decade. How come?
Well, I think you just have to look at the past election cycles. First, they lost the House and the Senate, particularly the House, for the first time since, I guess, in 80 years. And then they thought, well, this is a fluke.
This is in 06 you're talking
right,
about.
Then
yeah.
They lost it again.
In 08.
So there was this sense of, wait a minute, we better dig in and find a way to take back what we've traditionally had control of.
And they came roaring back in 2010.
They came roaring back. Although I think there were a lot of people who thought that that was a state roaring back, when more likely it was a national discontent among the electorate with incumbents. Because when I remember being at the polls, people were saying, we're just really, really unhappy. I'm voting against any incumbent. I don't care. And so we had this huge majority of Republicans in place. Well, then we had a Speaker, William O'Brien, elected by a narrow margin over a longtime veteran Gene Chandler, and who was a little bit considered more moderate or more establishment. And they did some things that I think filtered out. They focused on a number of gun issues, for example. They came in saying, we're going to do jobs in the economy, but that message just got drowned out. So next thing you know, we have another election, and Obama wins New Hampshire, and we have another turnover, although it wasn't quite as much. I think the Republicans thought they were going to lose 50 seats, and instead they lost the House. And the Senate is 13 to 11. So you have this discontent. What do we have to do to win back New Hampshire? And you see it on the national scale, too. What do we have to do? What do we have to do? People aren't hearing our message. Some people are saying it's the message. So I think they keep trying to find an answer. And this discontent is filtered out, obviously, to some of the towns.
Well, there was some news on the Democratic side, too, this week. Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Senator Gene Shaheen, up for re-election this year, received some controversial help this week from another U.S. senator, New Jersey's Bob Menendez. Now, why, first of all, would Menendez be helping Shaheen?
Well, Robert Menendez has been a high-ranking member of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. This is certainly considered an important seat for Democrats if they want to retain control of the Senate in 2014. So Menendez has actually been a very prodigious fundraiser in New Jersey, very successful at raising money for candidates all over the country. And we've seen Senator Gene Shaheen, who used to be governor, got a really late start in fundraising for this reelection, and it's really ramped up in the last couple of months. So virtually every week there are emails of all kinds going out, fundraising mail of all sorts from prominent Democrats all over the country trying to raise money for her. And she's had a pretty successful quarter that was just completed in March. She raised about $2 million.
So why is this help for Menendez problematic?
Well, Menendez has been involved in a pretty salacious controversy regarding associates of his from Miami and trips he had taken to the Dominican Republic, where it was alleged he had dalliances with women there that were provided by this campaign contributor and close supporter of his. He's also acted on behalf of this supporter for contracts in the Dominican Republic dealing with legislation there.
So this money, Republicans are saying, give it back, Senator Shaheen.
Right.
It's kind of funky.
Somehow tainted, yes.
Yeah, has she given it back yet?
No, she hasn't. And the charges have been kind of clouded somewhat. One of the leading informants in this story has essentially come forward and said, I made it up. And Menendez didn't really do purchase services from me.
All right, real quickly, Dan Tuohy, one of the fundraising appeals being made in Senator Shaheen's name is help her out in case Scott Brown decides to come up from Massachusetts, the former U.S. senator, and run against our Senator Shaheen. That's being used pretty successfully by New Hampshire Democrats.
Yes, as I understand it, the Menendez, he was soliciting money for Shaheen. It was one of the emails. And Ray Buckley, immediately after, Scott Brown said to reporters in Nashua a week ago, he's not ruling out anything. It's possible to run against Shaheen or another office in New Hampshire. He has a second home in Rye. Scott Brown has a few more high-profile visits to New Hampshire, including tomorrow in Manchester.
So he is coming up here and speaking. I mean, he's
yes.
making this look more than just idle reporter chatter.
Exactly. He has a book out. He's a Fox contract commentator. He's helping Jennifer Horne raise money for the Republican State Committee.
Wow. Okay. Well, one last quickie for you, Kevin, again. And I know this is a little funny for you, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Telegraph of Nashua has been sold. How come, and what does this mean for the many fine journalists who work there?
Well, the present owners, Independent Publications, essentially their board of directors and their upper management is past retirement age, and they were looking to liquidate all their assets. They owned a number of newspapers, radio stations. Their kind of cash cow is Muzak, the company that produces all that elevator music we hear going in and out of buildings. So they decided to sell the property and the business, and it's been purchased by a family newspaper chain, Ogden Family Newspapers. They own about 40 papers all over the country from New York to Hawaii.
All right. Well, I'll leave it at that for you right now. I know it's a little bit of a personal story for you, but good luck as that process goes through.
Thanks very much. Yeah. We're looking forward to hearing more news about it.
Yeah, and Norma Love, it's going to be a very busy week at the State House next week. What are you going to be especially watching, Norma?
I'm going to be at the gambling hearing. I'm going to be following the gambling committee.
That's
the big one. Yeah, I'm going to place my bets on gambling next week.
Place your bets, and you're going to be watching this super committee and seeing how it votes.
That's correct.
And then we'll find out what happens in May.
I think it'll probably be May because the subcommittees will want at least a couple of weeks to call people in. I mean, they really plan on giving this the full examination, and I think Norelli wants to make sure that everybody feels that it got a shot.
Yeah. Dan, what are you tracking next week?
Also, the casino bill on Tuesday and Wednesday. Also in the Senate on Thursday is that the bill to repeal the education tax credit program. The smaller issue, of course, but it really buzzes online. People are concerned about it one way or the other.
Yeah, that became very political last year, and there's a move to repeal it. Yeah,
yeah, and one more is the Honor Your Oath rally tomorrow at the State House. It's another one about, you know, gun rights advocates saying, you know, let's cease and desist with any legislation on control or affecting gun ownership.
Oh, okay. So a gun rights rally tomorrow at the New Hampshire State House.
Yeah, by Jack Kimball, the former state Republican chairman.
All right. And Kevin Landrigan, real quick, what are you tracking?
The education tax credit is really interesting to me, mainly because it could be one of Governor Maggie Hassan's first big defeats from the Republican Senate. Republicans in the Senate seem very unified against a number of these bills trying to undo the Republican agenda of 2011.
And again, Governor Hassan herself will be here on Monday, so I invite everyone to tune in for that. And I want to thank all of you very much for coming in today. I really appreciate it. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with New Hampshire Governor Maggie Hassan as she passes her 100th day in office. Then, with the April 15th deadline to file federal income taxes, we'll observe the 100th birthday of this national tax. Later, an update on autism, including new research which suggests some kids may outgrow it, and we'll end the week with our Friday News Roundup. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show with the domestic